The Tom Woods Show, episode 2151.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. So glad to welcome back to the show our old friend, Scott Horton. He is the libertarian foreign policy hero. He is, of course, the host of the Scott Horton Show. You can check him out at scotthorton.org. He's got a zillion things that he does. Editorial director for antiwar.com. He directs the Libertarian Institute. And of course, he was the resounding victor in his debate with Bill Kristol about foreign interventionism. And he recently had another debate that ended up with just as lopsided a result at Porkfest. And so we're going to start our conversation today talking about that. And then we're going to talk about the worst thing in the world and what we can do about it. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great, and I want to jump into this right away, but I do need to make a little bit of an exception here. I do want to take a minute. Could you please say something for those of us not fortunate enough to be at Porkfest? Just say a word about the debate, because I think you did another stomping of somebody. The same way you stomped Bill Kristol, somebody else got stomped trying to debate you at Porkfest. Can you talk about that for just a minute?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair characterization. And I apologize about the thunderstorm approaching out my window here. I hope it's not too much of an interruption. But what it was, of course, the great Gene Epstein of the Soho Forum moderated and hosted the debate. It was myself and Kathy Young from Reason Magazine and from The Bulwark, which is Bill Kristol's online magazine that kind of replaced the Weekly Standard, I guess. And the debate was whether America should arm a country. Obviously, Ukraine was the discussion, although Georgia came up, but a country attacked by Russia, and whether we should arm them and give them intelligence and that kind of thing. So that was the debate. And she didn't really have as much of an argument as she knew what I was going to say, more or less. So she tried to sort of preempt that. And then in her opening statement, where she's, you know, supposed to be making the case for arming Ukraine, she's basically trying to make the case for why what I'm about to say isn't really right or something like that. But then I don't think that really worked. So she didn't ever really make the case for, and it's hard in limited time, but I'm pretty sure that was the best she could do. And then I was, you know, just being myself, telling the same story I've told you before about on the show about how our presidents from Bill Clinton all the way through have provoked this conflict with Russia unnecessarily, and that the war with Russia is Putin's fault. I don't absolve him of his aggressive war. He must have had other options than that. But the new Cold War in which his invasion of Ukraine takes place is absolutely created by the West, led by the United States. And, you know, in direct contradiction with what they say, you can tell, right? It's almost like a psychological thing. Unprovoked attack. Because they don't even want the question raised. What might have preceded this that could have amounted to a provocation from the Russian point of view? It has to just be Russian aggression as a key catchphrase. And she made her case. And I guess when the video comes out, people will see what they think. But it was 98.44% to 1.66%, I think, was the final total. So I got the Tootsie Roll pop at the end.
Yes.
Thanks to Josh for that.
Right, because I guess it started off at, what, 70-something percent in your favor, and then it went to 98?
Right, and her friend that she brought with her voted for her, which was nice.
You're just brutal.
Well, she wrote a thing for The Bulwark this morning where she essentially, I mean, honestly, I'm not motivated enough to go and try to refute all of the things she said, but she takes me out of context and puts words in my mouth. You know, she kept saying, or she says in the debate and again in the article today, that I believe Putin. But the only things where I quoted Putin was things where he was threatening us over something, right? Like I said, in his declaration of war, he complained that Bill Clinton backed the terrorists in Chechnya. Well, I wasn't saying I believe him as the source for my information that Bill Clinton did that. I've got that from the Washington Post and from Stratfor and from the leader of the Senate Intelligence Committee staff who wrote, Yosef Berensky, who wrote this giant thing about it. And, you know, I thought it was in the WikiLeaks and I couldn't find it. I was panicking. The Stratfor emails. No, no, it's right there on their website. You read it right now. Stratfor.com. Chechnya, Saudi, CIA, 1990s. Have at it. So anyway, she was trying to like call me a kook or whatever, say I love Vladimir Putin. I get all my talking points from him and you hear him. The American side's talking points. You know what they are, but didn't seem to impress anybody.
But that's just so dumb. I mean, it's unbelievable that she would resort to that. That how does she not realize she's talking to an audience that's a little bit more sophisticated than people who can just be satisfied with, oh yeah, he gets his talking points from the Russians or whatever. But that's such a low IQ thing to say. And that she would try to get away with that in a debate with a libertarian is incredible to me.
And I had said quite clearly, which I do believe, I don't pander to anybody ever, that what Putin has done is an absolute horror, moral and legal crime. He started a war. You can't do that. He invaded a country. Now, it's complicated. It is Obama's fault and Trump's fault and Biden's fault and everybody else's fault too. But he didn't have to do that. And you know what? I really need to do the work on what his alternatives really were because, you know, one thing I heard Aaron Maté say, well, he could have just straight up cut off all gas to Europe and sent all his natural gas east instead. And that would have learned him if he'd done that all at once or if he had said, all right, well, I'm just going to veto the next 15 most important things on the UN Security Council or I demand whatever, 20,000 Indian peacekeepers to stand on the border of the Donbass and keep Kiev from attacking. You know, I say Indian because that's presumably they have no dog in this fight whatsoever, right? So they could just stand there and essentially keep the peace in the what was supposed to be settled under the Minsk II deal, long-term fighting in the east there. So in other words, I mean, that's just three ideas off the top of somebody else's head that I just plagiarized for you, but there must have been more things that he could have done. Actually, I think I made up the UN Security Council one. The other two I got from Aaron Maté. But certainly he didn't need to attack the way he did. He's killed tens of thousands of people. The whole thing's an absolute catastrophe. And it has, you know, strengthened the hand of his enemies in NATO. Hell, the story today, the head of NATO says they're now going to expand their rapid reaction force from 20 to 300,000 men. And they're going to dump more and more equipment into Eastern Europe. They want to bring Sweden and Finland in and all of this, just catastrophe all around. And so I said something like that. And then she goes, oh, I guess you just love Putin and think he's a perfect angel and just believe all the things he said. Again, when the only things I quote him was when he was making threats. And I was saying, yeah, we need to believe that. That when he says he's angry for a reason, we should believe him that he's angry. That was what I was saying. I wasn't saying he's the source of our, you know, knowledge in our footnotes for our claims about American foreign policy in fact, you know what I mean? Only in its effect.
Yeah. 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 Well, look, when the video comes out, that'll be all you need. And I'm so tempted. I might actually quote tweet her on that when she tweeted out her written response today. I would just like to say, look, folks, just wait till the video comes out. You can see for yourself what Scott said. Don't take her word for it.
Yeah, there's a bit of a contrast there, I think. Oh, and she, you know, one thing she says, she puts it in quotes that I called it a Nazi junta, but I never use that phrase because that's not what I'm saying. I called it an illegal coup d'etat junta, and the coup was backed by a bunch of Nazis. But from, of course, the very beginning, the first guy they installed in power as the prime minister was Yatsenyuk. He was, I think, Jewish. No, he was not Jewish. But he's definitely not. Well, he was a member of a very nationalist party, but personally, he was more of a bureaucrat type. And the first president they installed in there, Poroshenko, was not a national socialist, just a gangster and a criminal, you know, and some kind of nationalist. But in terms of military forces and militia forces on the ground fighting in the war, there's some serious Hitler-loving Nazis. That was a fun part. I'll tell you the thing. She's babbling something and says, well, I don't want to talk about the Azov Battalion. And I said, well, of course you don't want to talk about the Azov Battalion. What could you possibly say? Yeah, they're just moderate Hitler-loving Nazi rebels, you know? And she does kind of make that case. Oh, some of them used to be Nazis, but it's a very, very, very small percentage. She makes up this number. Oh, it's 0.0001% of the fighters are Nazis. And just like, come on, lady. I asked her, what's your footnote for that? Where'd you get that? You know, there are thousands of these guys have been fighting for the last half a decade there.
Yeah, did they survey them all? Like, how would you have that number?
Seriously.
Where would that come from?
The whole thing is absurd. It was fun, though. And I won.
Oh, of course. Of course. I know. And I got updated. I talked to you in person, actually, and said, how did the debate go? But I didn't get any more detail till just now. So this is great. Okay, let's get on to it. We're talking about a joint resolution before the House.
Yes.
Number 87, demanding an end to all support for the war in Yemen, so Saudi and UAE. And the Libertarian Party, under the leadership of Angela McArdle, has indeed been pushing to get this through, and I have gotten email from them. I've seen them online pushing it, and I know that you've been doing work on it, and you've been making the rounds on the podcasts. So we want to get this thing pushed through. So I guess what we're going to do is, again, go through the background here, because a lot of people know that what's happening in Yemen is a humanitarian catastrophe. But I think they think of it as being like trying to explain what was going on in Bosnia in the 1990s.
No, yeah.
I'm never going to understand it. So can you talk to us like we're seven and give us that background leading up to why we need this resolution?
Yeah, I think I can. I've told this story a lot of times, and I've gotten it through to a lot of people. So I'm pretty sure that with a fair shot here, as I've done on your show in the past, in fact, I think I can.
Oh, actually, wait, before you even start that, Scott, before you even start that, didn't Biden say at one point, and this was supposed to be like one decent thing he had said, that he's totally against this and he wants to stop it, then why do we need this resolution in the first place?
Well, that's the point, right? And it raises important questions about what good this would even do anyway, because as you know, he's the ruler of the world empire and no real, you know, as Al Gore said, there's no controlling legal authority over what I do, you know, as vice president. It's the same thing with Biden now as president, right? Unless the Senate's going to remove him from office, he can do whatever he wants, especially in terms of foreign policy. But the thing is, this is almost like a toothless resolution of censor or something like that in a way. However, it is the War Powers Resolution 1973, and it has been done before, and it was huge and historic and momentous when they did it in 2019. And the first time it was just the House passed, but the second time the House and the Senate passed it and Trump had to veto it. And, you know, unfortunately he did veto it at the behest of Raytheon. You won't be surprised to know. But, you know, the fact of the matter is actually as soon as they did that, the UAE withdrew their regular army and they still have their militia there. Otherwise known as Al-Qaeda, we'll get to that, but, and allies as well, other mercenary forces as well. But they pulled out their main forces and they sent their ambassadors to talk to the Iranians who are friends with the guys they're fighting there. And so it goes to show, you know, people always say if America doesn't hold the whole world together, everything will break out in violence, right? But you see where there's even a hint that, America's going to back off. Biden said he was going to back off. The Congress wants him to back off and all these things. You see, when Biden started saying, I'm skipping around, sorry, but when Biden started saying he wants to get out of there, UAE and Saudi both sent, UAE sent people straight to Tehran for more talks, and Saudi sent people to Baghdad to meet with the Iranians for talks in reaction to the Americans, you know, stopping backing them up. If you think about a little bully with a big bully behind it, but then the big bully loses interest, and the little bully decides maybe he's been talking too loud. And so that's how it's played out. But yes, it's true that Biden has betrayed that promise. In fact, it was just 2 months after he gave a speech announcing that he ended all support for the offensive war in Yemen. And then 2 months later, Admiral Kirby, the spokesman for the Pentagon, said, yeah, no, I mean, of course, we're still supplying them with maintenance and you know, resupply. And it's like he didn't go down the whole litany, but essentially he was conceding that, yeah, we're still giving them weapons. We're still giving them new tires and all spare parts for their jets. Still American mercenaries doing all the care and feeding of the planes, the logistics for carrying out the war and the intelligence for picking the targets and our Navy still helping enforce the blockade and the whole thing is still going on. So, you know, in a way it is just a matter of trying to make it a controversy, but I think, you know, the War Powers Resolution, they passed that over Nixon's veto and then they never touched it again until a couple of years ago. So as you know, Tom, as your listeners all know, Congress really wants to end this, they should just end all funding for it. But Nancy Pelosi ain't going to do that. So this is what we have to do. You know what I mean? This is what we can do. And then here's where it comes to the LP campaign thing real quick here on the call to action, is that we have automatically like 20,000 people on that mailing list that, you know, the core of the membership of the party. We got new members coming in all the time. The affiliate program is back up, Mr. Woods. I don't know if you saw that in your email.
I did.
For you and me and Dave and everybody for the affiliate program. So we're growing that. But so if the LP is doing this, and we can get as many of the different libertarian institutions and groups involved, and just, you know, I know I'm not trying to turn everybody into me on a permanent basis, but can't we all just be Yemen war first activists for a couple of weeks together, right? And we all do this together. We have these numbers and the multiplier too, your wives and your husbands and your girlfriends and your boyfriends and your next door neighbors and your coworkers, anybody that you know who's interested in this stuff. You'll look, here's actually, and let me say real quick too, that, and this is the end of the story, but it's important enough. We have a real ceasefire right now. We're in the third month of a very, very real ceasefire, a real chance for peace. The Saudis have abandoned the major mission that they're after here to reinstall the last dictator. So they've climbed down from that and have appointed some committee to figure it out, right? So that's all up in the air. And we have this resolution and we have the Libertarian Party now, and plus the whole movement that we already had anyway. And so now, what if we take the opportunity to press this advantage? And then I think that we ought to be able to mobilize. I'm not good at math, Tom. I mean, I don't know the statistics and the what have yous, but what if my imagination, I believe we could turn out what? 20, 30, 40,000 votes, 50,000 votes for everybody who will really work hard, get all your friends, all the groups that you're members of, you know, your roller derby team and your remote control truck team and your fishing league and your whatever you do, and get all those guys to call too. The multiplier effect there, as the Keynesians would call it, right? That could really matter. I mean, that could be like an earthquake, man. And look, I know it's just calling your congressman, but I was on a conference call with these Yemen activists and they said the staffers were telling them, more calls, please, because we're already won over to your cause. We're working on the boss, but we need to be able to tell him, her, that the phone is ringing off the hook. The people really care about this. Thousands and thousands of calls. I mean, that takes up a lot of time. How come you didn't do your job today? Because I've been fielding Yemen calls all day, boss. We have to make that the scene in their reality where they live, that this really matters to us. And then, I mean, I don't care. Only in fourth place do I care about the Libertarian Party getting any credit for this. And in fact, I think when people are calling their Congress, or the Libertarian movement for that matter, when you're calling your congressman, if they're a Republican, you should talk to them like you're a Republican too. And if they're a Democrat, you should talk to them like you're a Democrat too. And then after the fact, we'll still be able to claim our credit for helping to do this thing. But that's not the important part. The important part is, what if we really get it passed, the House and the Senate, and even with like veto-proof majorities, some huge dream come true type scenario, he could still veto it and he still could ignore it, somehow go around it. But I think that would be huge. And I think there's a real chance that that would be the thing that we need. The Congress is insisting now, we have this chance for peace. President Biden, see it through to do this. And of course, you know, he's trying to suck up to the Saudis right now and get them to increase oil production. But see, I think they want out of this war too. It hasn't worked and it's not going to work. And the Houthis keep hitting inside Saudi. And so there's got to be a way that we can do this. And look, you know what? The groundswell of popular public pressure against the war in Yemen for years has been unimaginable. You know, this is not the cause celeb of a single TV commentator. You know what I mean? There's no one famous who's made this their big issue. Not Mark Ruffalo or Tucker Carlson or anyone. You know what I mean? It's just not that big of a thing. Nobody knows that much about it. We don't have tens of thousands of soldiers on the ground there, right? But still, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who've been working on this so hard. And there's such a groundswell. As I said, they already got the War Powers Resolution passed before a couple of years ago. So it's really an incredible thing. And it's, you know, I'm not a big believer in democracy and all that, but it's what we've got to try to pressure them to stop supporting this thing. And so now, if you want, I'll explain why it's worth it and explain this backstory here, unless you had another question about the, oh, I could tell you the phone number. You call 833-STOP-WAR and it'll connect you. You type in your zip code and it'll, and that's not 100%, but pretty much it'll connect you to your congressman. And then,
oh, that's great.
It's perfect. It's a, it works so easy. 833-STOP-WAR. And in fact, it's 1-833-STOP-WAR.com. If you need a couple talking points, a little bit of instruction there, they have it right there. 1-833-STOP-WAR.com there. And they have that. And it's HJ Res 87, the War Powers Resolution on Yemen. And it's fresh and new. It was just introduced a couple of weeks ago, right? All these things are coinciding together. The ceasefire, the LP takeover, and all of these things are all happening at once. So it's a new, fresh thing. It's a big deal. The number of co-sponsors keeps going up. It's up to 91 co-sponsors now, including 11 Republicans. Let's get that up to 30 Republicans, to 50 or whatever we can, right? And especially attack the right from the right, America first, and all that kind of messaging, you know? Thomas Massie's supporting it. Plagiarize him. Tell your congressman the best thing you heard Massie say about it. You know, it's out there.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Hey folks, I don't know if you've ever experienced burnout, but I am the poster child for burnout. As I've said over and over again, for those 2 years that I worked on the Ron Paul curriculum, I was just stretched to the limit. It was nonstop work because I was also doing the Tom Woods Show and also traveling around the world giving lectures and doing all these sorts of things. And plus, I'm a dad and I have lots of responsibilities, but I'd bought into this crazy modern idea that if I had any free moments, like the 10 minutes I'm waiting for an oil change or the 20 minutes I'm waiting in line at the post office, that all that time has to be filled by work. No time for reflection, relaxation, doing something pleasurable, whatever. But work is not the only cause of burnout. Any of our roles in life can lead us to feel burned out. And you can feel like you have a lack of motivation. You can feel irritable, fatigued. Well, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with someone can help you figure out what's causing stress in your life. And by the way, I'm very happy to tell you that I myself have used BetterHelp in the past, and it did wonders for me. I was matched with somebody who understood my situation exactly and helped me get back on track. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/woods. That's betterhelp.com/woods.
Tom, did you have any other follow-up before I start on the history here?
Yeah, one quick follow-up.
Sure.
You were saying that there are no celebrities who have made this their cause, and so it's kind of just, it's been way, way too much in the background. But I guess my question would be, we have a lot of passionate people, though, who are nevertheless against it. They're just, nobody knows who we are, unfortunately. But who is the constituency for this thing?
Oh, the Saudis.
I don't ever
and
come across
dealers.
Any, but yeah, see, the Saudis. But I mean, I don't ever in ordinary life come across anybody saying, I sure hope we stick it out in Yemen.
You get a little
no
bit,
one says that.
You get a little of that because the fake threat here is Iran. And you can always find people who are partisans of Israel and who are just, you know, have the experience and been propagandized their whole lives about the danger of the Ayatollah and all of that. Although I'll get to how overblown that is here in a minute. But that would be the justification
right.
If you ever hear anything is what about Iran?
Okay.
What about Iran? But of course,
okay.
As anyone listening to this could guess, Iran's influence in Yemen has increased lately rather than the other way around. So,
but not to mention, look, Scott, there are some things you just can't do regardless of the consequences. You know, I mean, it's like the who would pick the cotton argument about slavery. Well, you know what? I don't know. Maybe nobody. But you can't do
right.
that to people.
Seriously.
You know, maybe nobody would pick the cotton, but you still can't do that.
Yep.
And so likewise, I don't know what'll happen with Iran, but I do know you can't starve people. You know, you can't do that.
Yep, exactly right.
All right, go ahead. Give us the background and give us a briefing again that somebody without that much background can grasp.
I'll do that. We can do this together. We've done this before. So all right, everybody.
We have.
We're talking about the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula there. Now the whole peninsula is tilted toward the southwest, right? In your mind's eyes there, right between Egypt and the rest of the Middle East. And in Iran, right, the Persian Gulf is on the right, the Red Sea is on the left, separating the Arabian Peninsula from the Horn of Africa there in Somalia and Djibouti. So it's that southwest corner, and in the rectangle lies flatways, you know, widthwise, but the eastern half of the country is pretty much all desert. Mostly what we're talking about here is in the western half of the country, and that's you can divide it essentially in thirds. The southern part is mostly controlled by the Socialist Southern Transitional Council, left over from the old Soviet days, leaning left like that. Then in the center is the capital city of Sana'a. And that's where a lot of the politics we'll be talking about takes place. And then far up in the north of the country is the Sada province, where the Houthis are from. And they're a group of Zaydi Shiites. And we'll be talking a lot about them there, too. So easy enough for everybody's mind's eye to get us started here. So 2009, Obama comes in, tells the CIA, I want you to drone bomb Al-Qaeda in Yemen. They make a deal with the dictator and pay him with money and guns to let America fly drones killing Al-Qaeda guys there. Now, of course, this is a total catastrophe because it's not a surgical strike. For the people below, they're getting torn apart and collateral damage everywhere. And it does nothing but increase support for Al-Qaeda in the South as a government program would. But they were targeting their enemies, trying, instead of just doing a bait and switch and targeting people who had nothing to do with anything. These are the guys who bomb the coal, you know. They make a deal with the dictator, Abdullah Saleh, there in Sana'a, the capital city. And they give Saleh money and weapons as his bribe so that they can bomb Al-Qaeda down there in the south. Well, he takes the money and weapons and attacks the Houthis in the north, which is also counterproductive because every time he attacks them, they get stronger and keep defeating his forces and driving them back. And he's playing a double game, by the way. He's backing Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood forces along with his military against the Houthis. But he's also playing a triple game and backing the Houthis against his own military and the Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood forces that he's stabbing us in the back, supporting against them because he's afraid of his own military and they're getting a bit too big for his britches. So he's kind of wearing them down in the fight. Might be why the Houthis are winning over and over again in this thing. These are Yemeni politics, okay? So 2011 comes and it's the Arab Spring and there's successful peaceful revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt. And so all across the Middle East, Day of Rage protests. Now, 90% of all of these countries are, of course, American-backed monarchies or emirs and sultans and el presidentes and so forth around. And in this case, a so-called president, Saleh. And everybody wants rid of him. And everybody comes to the capital city and they have a peaceful protest and everybody's getting along. Houthis and Muslim Brotherhood guys and Southern Socialists. I don't know about Al-Qaeda guys. But everything was going okay. But Saleh wouldn't step down. And so people started trying to kill him. And somebody bombed him and wounded him. So he had to leave the country and go to Saudi Arabia to heal up from being attacked, all right? Dictator's out of the picture. In comes Hillary Clinton. She comes in and with the Saudis, thwarts the will of the people who want a whole new constitution and a whole new way of doing things around here. And she says, no, 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 you're going to be happy with the vice president and helps to shore up support for him among, you know, different factions passing out money and backing the Saudi role there. Well, the vice president is a guy named Mansour Hadi, and he's terrible. Well, first of all, Saleh goes away mad. He doesn't go retire to a life of farming like George Washington or a quiet life of study like Mullah Omar. He goes and joins forces with the Houthis. Turns out he's a Zaydi Shiite just like them, even though he's not a Houthi. And so he makes an alliance with them. He takes about 2/3 of his army with him. And so now they're this ultra powerful force in the north of the country. Meanwhile, Hadi is a terrible dictator and cuts the gasoline ration and passes whatever taxes and regulations and horrible things that drive everyone crazy. And he implements a strong federalism program, which essentially means drawing hard state borders where before there had just been regions, which was a threat to cut the Houthis off from the Red Sea. Well, they go to war and start marching down on the south of the capital. At the end of 2014, the Houthis, allied with the former dictator Saleh, take the capital city and drive Hadi out of power. Now, Obama himself admitted, I've seen him on camera say, the Iranians warned the Houthis not to do this. Now, they're not really Iranian ally at this time. They're kind of the Iranians' acquaintances or friends, but not their allies or have any real relationship with them. And they're this tiny sub-state group with not much power. What are they going to do? But at this point, they're marching on the capital, and the Iranians advise them, don't take the capital city because the Saudis are going to freak out and go to war. Maybe they knew that from their intelligence. I don't know. But they at least figured that. And Obama himself admitted that that was true. Well, the Houthis ignored the Iranians and took the capital city anyway. And then even though they proposed immediately negotiations with all different factions, they knew they couldn't just rule the city as rule the whole country as some totalitarian power. They knew they had to cut deals with everybody to stay in power. And so they wanted a new constitutional convention. They were literally going to create a bicameral Congress or a bicameral parliamentary system, Tom, where there would be a lower house for women and the youth to have their interests represented was the idea that the Houthis had floated in the first place. But the upper house would have tribes and powers and factions from all over the country would have their say. They didn't think they could have power otherwise. Well, then the bombs come falling right out of the sky and destroy the whole thing. And the New York Times quoted the Obama people explaining why they gave the green light for this to happen. Now, of course, America is the world empire and Saudi is the client state. They can't do this without us. And they wouldn't have dared to do it without American cooperation in the first place. And they came to Obama and said, you know, can we? And the Obama team decided, yeah, let's let them do it. And then later they told their whole story to the New York Times. It's not a scoop. It's one of those based on 17 sources from inside the government saying they knew the war would be long, bloody, and indecisive, right? Meaning a lot of people are going to get exploded to death, and we have no idea what victory is even supposed to look like here. Long, bloody, and indecisive, but we have to do it to placate the Saudis over the Iran nuclear deal. Now, the Iran nuclear deal was guaranteeing the Saudis' military interests, right? Locking down the Iranian nuclear program more than ever before. But it was also scaring the Saudis and making them think that Obama was going to tilt back toward Iran and against them, which that was never going to happen. All he was trying to do was take the threat of war off the table there. Nobody thought Obama was going to tilt back, make a deal with the Ayatollah and turn against Saudi Arabia and back towards the Persians like the 70s. That was just absolutely not on the table whatsoever during that time. But they were worried that they were going to lose their place in our order in the Middle East as top dog, junior top dog, right? And then Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince Bonesaw, had just become the 29-year-old brand new defense minister and deputy crown prince. So public choice theory kicks in. He starts a war for his own personal selfish political interests inside the royal family. And as everybody remembers, he rounded up and arrested all the billionaires and stole all their money. Remember that? Well, he also locked up his cousin, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, who was set to be king, and had him arrested, locked in solitary somewhere and took his place and is now known as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and is essentially the de facto king of the country. His father is a senile old man in his late age. And so he's running the place and the war helped him do it. So that was part of why they launched the war in the first place. And then they called it Operation Decisive Storm, long, bloody, and indecisive, in fact. But they called it Decisive Storm and they launched it. And then that was 7 years ago in... Oh, and I skipped a step. I'm sorry, we're short on time. I'll try to talk faster, Tom. Wall Street Journal and Al Monitor reported in January of 2015 that our current Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, who was then a four-star general, the commander of Central Command, he was passing intelligence to the Houthis to use to kill Al-Qaeda, right? To an Al-Qaeda guy, the only good Shiite is a dead Shiite. So Lloyd Austin said, hey, you guys like killing Al-Qaeda? And the Houthis were like, yes. And he said, well, here's some intelligence and where you can find them. And the Houthis to the Wall Street Journal confirmed it from Yemen's side of the story. They sent a reporter to confirm it that, yep, the Americans have been giving us intelligence lately to use against AQAP. That's January 2015. 2 months later, Obama stabs them in the back and takes Al-Qaeda's side against them because, of course, Saudi and UAE have been backing Al-Qaeda in the war ever since. And not only that, but just... the war completely destroyed the Houthis, any ability they had to create a monopoly on force and prevent Al-Qaeda from taking over a whole bunch of towns. And I talk about this in Enough already. They took over 7 towns, including the major port city of Mukalla, and then 6 more towns after that. Huge tax bases. They cut taxes, but still made billions. And, you know, because there's port towns and all kinds of trade going on up and down the coast there. And then they seized military bases and weapons magazines. And it was a huge deal, Tom, until about 2017. It became such a scandal that the Americans put pressure on the UAE that this is embarrassing us. You have to do something about it. So the UAE went in there, Tom, and wiped them out. No, I'm just kidding. They went in there and hired them all and integrated them into their militia. And so just like Michael Horton, no relation to me, the real Yemen expert from the Jamestown Foundation, told Mark Perry back in 2015, in March of 15, he told Mark Perry, John McCain complains we're flying as Iran's Air Force in Iraq. That would be against ISIS. Well, we're flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force in Yemen. And that's been true this whole time. And now quickly to the humanitarian situation. This is the poorest country in the Middle East in the first place. When this war started, all the humanitarian organizations screamed their head off. You can't do this. You can't do this. These people are so poor, they import 80 to 90% of their food right now. And that's partially because the IMF and the World Bank had gangsterized them, you know, into welcome to global capitalism. And of course, it's government policy, right? It's not like the farmers decide. It's government policy. So go along with us, you'll get a big loan. Stop growing sorghum and millet and other grains and whatever sustenance crops for your population and just grow more cotton and more coffee for export to the world market. And then you'll be eating Brazilian steaks and Florida oranges and all these things. And welcome to global capitalism. It's great, like in Ricardo or something like that, until the US Navy puts you under blockade and pulls the Star Destroyers in orbit off of your coast there, where now you can't do anything, and which is exactly what happened. They call it the Saudi blockade, but who rules the seven seas, Tom Woods? The US Navy does. And they've been enforcing that blockade all along. And in fact, if you just search US Navy Yemen and put minus missile, because there was one time the Houthi shot a missile at a boat, you'll get a million answers for that. But take missile out and you'll just see where the US Navy seizes this, that, and the other thing. And a lot of times it's overblown claims about Iranian smuggling. But they seize things all. And in other words, they're the ones enforcing the blockade. You see it all the time. I know a guy who was in the Navy who helped enforce the blockade his own self, throwing medical supplies in the ocean, because that's how we do business. So the thing of it is that the people have been starving and there's been massive cholera outbreaks. And because of the diffusion of responsibility, because we're leading from behind, that means that when America is, you know, only 98% responsible for what's going on here, but all the bad part of it, that's Saudi's fault. So they bomb hospitals, they bomb the waterworks, they bomb the electricity, they bomb the sewage. And in the middle of a cholera outbreak, they'll bomb the cholera hospital. I mean, it was just absolutely no mercy. And they bomb the farms, they bomb all the factories, you know, they bomb the grain silos. I've said this over and over. They bomb the grain silos, they bomb the flocks of sheep in the field and all the irrigation ditches and the horses in their stables and everything that they can. The fishermen's boats, the truck dealership, the potato chip factory, right, or any kind of food processing facility of any kind. Anything that is, you know, the basic distribution systems of the absolute basic necessities for life in the country, they've targeted it all along. And the people have just been starving to death and dying of otherwise easily treatable diseases. You know, the common cold that would have never killed you, but when you're starving to death, it does. And that kind of thing, especially, of course, little children. That's who dies of cholera, is little babies. And it's just an absolute nightmare. You know, the official UN numbers are somewhere around 500,000 civilians have been deprived to death, never mind the 100,000 or so who've been bombed to death. But I guarantee you, man, from how this has gone all this time, it's just a bet. But I'm telling you, when the epidemiologists do the excess death rate, you're going to find that it is more than 1 million civilians have been killed in this war. It's an absolute atrocity. But now, so the thing of it is, it didn't work, right? All they did was kill all these people, and the Houthis are still right there. And the Houthis are getting better and better at 3D printing drones and flying them across the border and blowing up Saudi oil refineries and all of this kind of stuff. So the Saudis have just backed themselves into a corner. They've gotten nowhere with any of this. And so I think they're ready to quit. Their latest push, where they dropped their demand of reinstalling Hadi in power and this kind of thing, that happened after one more massive attack at a refinery. Like somebody got mad enough at the crown prince that he had to make a change, is what it seems like happened there. So again, this is our chance to press that advantage. That here, this thing is just so horrible. We cannot be a party to this thing. And if we stop being a party to it, it's over. If Joe Biden puts his foot down and tells the crown prince, we got to call off this war, let's do something else other than this, then it'll happen. But so it's up to us, the tens of thousands of us, and the millions of us in the libertarian movement, right? There should be millions of us who are willing to just make a phone call, recruit people you know to make a phone call during business hours, talk to your members of Congress, attack the right from the right and the left from the left, insist they co-sponsor this thing and support this thing, and let's just call an end to it. It's genocide. It's treason. It's as bad as Iraq War II. And here's something that you can do to press the advantage. 833-STOP-WAR.
All right. I know you are on a strict schedule because, of course, you are trying to get the word out about this. So I'm not going to keep you, but I will urge everybody. I know you're all going to say, oh, I don't want to call my congressman. You know what? Take your libertarian grandstanding and stick it for just 5 minutes. And you don't even need 5 minutes because it's not going to kill you to do 833-STOP-WAR because sometimes they do things because people call.
It does make a difference. I know because the activists have told me on my show for years. It does make a difference. They've seen it with their own eyes. I ain't been to DC but a few times, Tom. But they've seen it with their own eyes over and over. It does matter. Jeff Dice says, the margin, that's where all the action is. That's us.
Exactly. And that is us. And there are a lot of lives at stake. So everybody go do that. I'll have all this stuff up at tomwoods.com/2151. Scott, go on your way spreading the good word. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, my friend.
All right, folks, tomorrow it's going to be just your host here with no guest. It's a tribute episode, I guess you could call it. It's an episode that brings me no joy, but that I have to record because justice demands it. I'll just leave it there. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.